This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
In Keystone XL Pipeline News, KETV Omaha is reporting that a husband and wife who don't want the proposed pipeline to run through their farm have deeded a plot of their land over to a Native American tribe, creating a potential roadblock for the project. Art and Helen Tandarup signed over a 1.6-acre plot of land to the Ponca Indian tribe on Sunday. The Ponca enjoys special legal status as a federally recognized tribe. The land has been used as a planting space for sacred Ponca corn for the last 5 years and was chosen in part because it sits on the $8 billion pipeline's proposed route. It's also part of the historic route that Ponca tribe members were forced to take when the U.S. government relocated them to present-day Oklahoma in 1877. Art and Helen Tandarup have been fighting this pipeline for years and even hosted a benefit concert on their land featuring Neil Young and Willie Nelson. The Kansas City Star reported on Friday that the Missouri Department of Natural Resources has issued a permit to a Lone Jack feedlot that could bring thousands of beef cattle to a location bordering $350,000 homes and just 3 miles upwind from Powell Gardens. Currently housing fewer than 999 head, the Valley Oaks Steak Company facility was classified as a Class 2 animal feeding operation, but the state's approval of a Class IB operating permit allows the feedlot and slaughterhouse to house up to 6,999 cattle in roofed open-air structures. A DNR news release on Friday said that parties adversely affected or aggrieved by the department's decision may appeal to the Administrative Hearing Commission by filing a written petition before July 16th. According to its permit request, the company would blend the feedlot's manure with wood chips and stored in a warehouse to be processed into marketable fertilizer. The DNR says plans proposed by Valley Oaks were within the Missouri Clean Water Law and Missouri Clean Water Commission regulations. The expected appeals of the permit issuance are apt to stretch out for months. DNR procedures call for the 7-member Missouri Clean Water Commission to review the matter, a department spokeswoman said, and further appeals could go through the court system.
All right, good evening, everyone. This is Richard Mabian, and welcome to Eco Radio. I come to the show tonight with a heavy heart, and as it is always, anytime I come on after some tragedy, I'd say it would be remiss for me to start this show without taking time to show our condolences for the two officers who got killed over in Wyandotte County last week. I am so grieved to their families, to the law enforcement community, to the debate that's going on between the various communities and the treatment that they're receiving from law enforcement. You know, debate is lively, debate is good, but when you have a tragic incident like this to happen, all debate has to come to an end for a minute. And let's do what we as a Christian neighborhood or a loving neighborhood, that loving community knows to do, and that's to show our care and concern for the families and the people that are most affected by this. So I had to do that. I just think that's a necessity. I know a lot goes on and you never hear about the good stuff, but the relationship that I, as president of Kansas City, Kansas NAACP, and also the first black board member for Kansas Sierra Club, has been able to establish with the law enforcement community has been off the hook in Wyandotte County. They've been there step by step with me on all the things that we want to do or have been trying to do. And for that, I thank God for them and the service, and I grieve grieve very deeply for the two people who got lost. Okay, with that said, we'll move into the program. Boy, has it been hot. I mean, it's hot. And and the air conditioning in my car is gone. I got to get it replaced. So, I mean, I end my day. I live up some steps. You got to climb some steps to get from the street to my house. And every night, I mean, if you can see me trying to walk in my house, I'm looking in slow motion like a robot, just taking one step at a time, dragging my damp, burn-up body behind me. So I'm looking forward to the rain. I've been passing out lights to elderly since January. I probably didn't get started till around February. And either it was cold, hot, snow, ice. I mean, I've dealt with every kind of weather you can name. And so when I saw they said it was going to be raining mostly for the rest of the week, I told my missus, I'm going to go pass out lights so I'll be out in the rain. At least I know I won't be burning up. We have one of my favorite guests here tonight. Zach, you want to say hello to everyone?
Sure. Hi, everyone. Zach Pastora, the lobbyist for the Kansas Sierra Club.
See, I learned now to let him tell you what he is because I get started on it and can't even get it out straight. Zach and I have been together this week. We were together almost 3 days. We was together Monday at the Wealth meeting, and Wealth stands for?
Water, Energy, Air, Land, Transportation, and Health.
And Health. That's the organization. Thanks, Zach. I've been lost on that, too. And we meet and do things together with each other to push those issues, to push those subjects. And we had a meeting up in Lawrence, which we do routinely, maybe about every 3 months, and talk about where we go from here. And then Thursday and Friday we were
at the Kaufman Foundation Center, Center, working on a voter civic engagement program.
Civic engagement. Voting this year, whether you know it or not, has become a contracted service and to get out the vote. I mean, many agencies in our metropolitan area receive funding to work on increasing the voter turnout in the upcoming elections in August and also November. So the organizations that Zach and I belong to are associated with that. They call it integrated voting or something.
Yeah.
Like that. Yeah. And so this was a big one over here Thursday and Friday. Meeting with some of the key organizations and agencies in town. And the reason I'm bringing it up on an environmental show is because that's what we promote. We promote the reason for people to vote based on environmental decisions that are being made around the country and in the state houses and various places. And so when we talk to folks about making sure they get registered and making sure they go out and vote, we do so with the concerns for us being able to vote for folks who are going to think about the environment in the manner that
right.
we see fit. Right.
Well, and for good reason. I mean, from what I understood, only 36% of registered voters actually voted.
Yes.
36%. And so if we equate that to, I mean, that's really low, and that's a shame for
right.
a country built on democracy. For us to be able to, as a community, step up and demonstrate that our voice is heard.
Right.
And it's the only way our representative politics, democracy is going to work. And I think that equates to the environmental scene. If people don't have a voice in making the harms of the environment known, then nothing will change.
Right.
And environmental degradation will happen, lack of prosperous ecosystems and communities will happen if people don't exercise the right to vote.
You know, we just had a conversation in the green room with Mike Murphy involved with us, and it had to do with the session that Zach was in today, and this is a good leeway into that. The concern was about how your today expecting mothers have determined that they're not going to eat any of this bad food. And Zach was in a meeting today, and I'll let you speak on it, Zach, where he was talking to those people who grow the food about the need for us to start having food that's going to be appropriate for our new wave of mothers. And what happened, the question came up, well, how has it always been that way? And then Mike and I was adding in that back in the day, parents have always been concerned, but like Mike said, they just kind of thought that somebody out there was keeping an eye on it and it would be okay. And, you know, it's just now that we realize that that hasn't been true, you know. And so now the new wave of mothers are determined. So go ahead, share a little bit about
sure,
that.
Yeah. And, you know, the clarified bad food we're talking about is not like donuts sugar. We could talk about that, yeah. You know. There's concern there. But we're talking about foods really finding out with, you know, heavily laced with pesticides or herbicides that we thought were safe and now finding out they're less safe than what we thought. So there's some of that going on. And then, you know, getting into antibiotics and food and all that stuff that we didn't necessarily think would transfer into affecting people down the line. But now the more science is showing that it does affect us.
Right.
To your point, I just came back from a meeting in Manhattan. So it was trying to remember that I need to offset my carbon footprint a little bit with driving a lot. But I was coming back from a meeting with farmers sitting around the table talking about the farm bill. And so the farm bill, you know, has a direct effect on farmers, you know, what they grow, the crop insurance type that they may have, how they get into farming in the first place. We talked about everything from having the labor force needed, and that goes into immigration issues and getting folks who will be able to work on farms. If there's nobody around, they can bring up via visa program laborers from Mexico, and how that has an effect on agriculture in Kansas, believe it or not, but also housing and rural flight. You know, if folks leave the community in pursuit of economic opportunity or a job somewhere else, then who is going to take care of that farm? And now we have farmers nervous about keeping the farm going with the level of debt. Farming has changed quite a bit, where you had a need for a lot of people, right. And now you got specialized equipment, high dollar equipment, some of those things. But one thing I talked with you before we came on here was there's not as necessarily a direct concern or connection between urban agriculture and how that, in providing healthy foods in the inner city, has to deal with maybe a farm bill.
Right.
Too.
Yeah.
I mean, a farm bill, we think of as affecting farmers, but it affects everyone here in our society with food prices and all that stuff.
Well, you know, and that was one of the things that really made me a supporter of Kansas City Community Gardens. Yes, they're out teaching folks how to grow community gardens the right way, the proper food, the proper whatever, this and that. But the main thing they have in mind, their long-range vision, is that everyone has a raised bed garden in their backyard. That is where we need to be going, so we're making sure people are receiving and getting the kind of food that they want. One thing that I noticed in the inner city, the transportation is a major issue. And regardless of how many places that you can establish that sell good food, again, I'm talking freshly grown garden products, having it in a position that the people who need it the most can get to it is a problem. So we have to be able to, while we're doing all this, use these community gardens to show people a visual of what can be done. But at the same time, we need to be trying to figure out how we can teach a future population to be doing this in their yards.
Right.
And having the raised beds eliminates the possibility of just tainted dirt and soil that you'd be planting into, because you got a lot of property that has had homes turned over into the ground. And so you got all kinds of chemicals and toxins just down in the ground. So if we concentrate on dealing with the raised bed garden and deal with the proper soil, that can make a difference.
Right. Good point. I think that's a great point, because too often we say, well, just plant something in the ground, but they don't know what's coming up out of that ground, and then if you're eating it. Point you made, I thought was interesting, educating the next generation, the next population here. The average age of Kansas farmer is 58 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, so, I mean, we need to, we want to make sure that we have not only the agricultural industry, but be able to feed our own people.
Right.
We're going to need some younger farmers in the equation somewhere, bring down that median age. The other thing I point out all the time is we import like 96% of our fruits and vegetables. We're a top 10 agricultural state.
Right.
But, in fact, we're not growing. We're only growing 4% of our fruits and vegetables in our own top 10 agricultural state. Just doesn't make any sense. And where we're talking about, that's the type of food, if the USDA food plate, it's not a pyramid anymore, it's a plate.
Right.
Half of that, of your plate, supposed to be fruits and vegetables. And we're losing out on, you know, millions of dollars, potentially billion-dollar industry by not growing it ourselves. It's the same, we talk often about, well, most of our energy comes from Wyoming.
Yeah.
You know, in the terms of coal coming down to Kansas. It's like, if we want to be a self-sufficient, resilient community, prosperous, and like we can make money, we can gain jobs by people growing their own food, selling it to the local grocery store, but also on the consumer end, being having folks be able to eat healthy food that they get locally as opposed to trucking it in.
Right.
Those are all big concerns there. So
well, and it's the direction that, you know, I was speaking to someone yesterday and told them that we've attacked this environmental world from all kind of angles, and we've penetrated to depths that before was unknown that we could even be able to reach that far. But the conclusions after getting there have been far and in between. That has been something that we ended up being a plus for those of us either doing the work or the people we were doing the work for. So we find ourselves with those circumstances still existing. We still have polluted air. We still have particulates in the air that's floating around up here. We still have people in positions that they need to be cognizant of the fact of the water that they drink, like a Flint.
Right.
We still have those problems. We got all this stuff going on, but we still have those problems. So we need to become more cognizant of educating people of ways they can start protecting themselves and their family. And the things we're talking about right now is the key to it. You know, I would love to see the powers to be become more conscientious about what we're teaching in our schools, what we're teaching for our future, to be able to pick up the slack when the things we know now no longer exist. There's an ending. There's a we those of us who have explored this know that there's a dead end down there on a lot of things that we're doing. And so we know that it's coming, whether it's 50 years from now or 100 years from now, there's a dead end down there. And we need to figure out ways to start educating the future generation how to keep this this planet resilient.
Sure, sure, yeah. Hopefully there's not a dead end, depending on which way we need to take, you know. We need to figure out a different course there. Well said, Richard. Yeah. I think education has always been about building a brighter future, evolving society, and we can get there. I mean, a lot of this stuff doesn't happen in silo or in isolation. In fact, Kansas City's doing a lot, in my mind, from, you know, kind of perspective, outside perspective, I'm seeing Kansas City with their farmers market growing in popularity, with the KC Food Circle, a lot more farm-to-table, people concerned with getting local foods on the dinner menu, people growing their own foods and community garden projects. So there is a lot of optimism there. So just to make it more of a mainstream, regular staple in society, you know, that's a big chore.
We're going to take our first break, and we'll be back after these messages.
Hi, this is Bill Sundahl here at KKFI, and I want to say thank you so much to Californos for sustaining our volunteers during the last fund drive. We appreciate it when a family-owned business supports KKFI. For the entire 30 years that KKFI has been on the air, Californos has been a supporter. Thanks to the staff and to the Barksdale, the Burns, the Lillig, and the Swift families. We look forward to another 30 years of partnership.
All right, this is Richard Mabian, and if you want to join this conversation, come on and give us a call. Don't wait until the last minute to do so. 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534.
KKFI is throwing a party June 30th at the Folly Theater, and you're invited. Two all-star bands backing over 20 great artists reflecting the diversity of our community. Doors at 7, shows at 8, tickets beginning at just $15. More info at kkfi.org/events.
For pet's sake, avoid the algae on this current cast. Too many nutrients in lakes and ponds can cause algae to grow out of control, producing harmful algal blooms. Some unleash toxins that threaten our health. And our animals, too. When ingested, touched, or even inhaled, they can make your pet sick or even die. So what can you do?
Well, the first step is prevention.
That's Karen Bischoff of Cornell University. She says you cannot tell by looking if a bloom makes toxins or not, so keep animals away. If you catch Fido in green, scummy water, remove him quickly and don't let him lick his paws or fur.
The best bet is to get him cleaned up as fast as possible and consult with a veterinarian.
When it comes to your precious pet, it's better to be safe than sorry. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Supported by New York's Environmental Protection Fund and Sea Grant. Online at currentcast.org.
All right, this is Richard Mabian again. And for those of you who got mesmerized by that, hearing my voice on the phone with a PSA and didn't get the number, that number is 816-931-5534. If you want to get involved in this conversation with Zach and I, give us a call, 816-931-5534. Okay, Zach, let's go hot topics. Give me hot topics up in
Topeka. Hot topics. So, you just heard it over the radio, water and blue-green algae. It's a serious concern for Kansas. I think we had 20-some lakes, reservoirs in Kansas get the blue-green algae. I was hearing from my folks who went to camping at the lake over the weekend, and they said that lake that they were at has a blue-green algae problem. So
can you see it?
Yeah, you can see it. It's kind of bright green, but if you didn't know, you would just think it's any kind of algae.
Okay.
But, yeah, it's got a kind of a tint to it. In fact, I've heard of folks up above, I believe it's Tuttle Creek Reservoir. If not, it's Milford. One of the two, there's a community up there named Wakefield, and they're having to deal with the extreme odor from this algae issue. And it's, I mean, they say it makes it unbearable to, you know, like having a big, you know, what would you think of a corporate hog farm or something like that right next to you. Just the smell is unbearable. And so that's one of the effects, a loss of recreation, opportunity, people going to visit the lakes. If it's shut down on 4th of July because of blue-green algae, that's a lot of lost revenue.
Right.
If things don't get bought up at the local stores and all that, that's just a water quality problem. We're dealing with water quantity across the state with groundwater and the aquifer continuing to be depleted, dropping by feet, especially in a drought, you know, scenario like what we're currently experiencing. The aquifer is dropping feet, and the natural recharge is maybe just inches. And then you have reservoirs on the eastern side of the state silting in with sediment that come off from extreme rains and short periods of time, releases from other lakes are causing sediment to get in the streams and then into the reservoirs. Well, that sediment is building up and replacing the water storage. So we're not having as much water storage. So a good example is how that affects us all is Kansas taxpayers had to pay 20-some million dollars in bonds for this dredging project. And that dredging project was going to do a value for 2.5 years, make enough water storage for about 2.5-3 years of water availability. So that's a pretty expensive price tag.
Especially if it's not working.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's just going to continue to fill in with sediment, so we're going to have to dredge it again. But that's not the only lake we're looking at. We're looking at quite a few reservoirs across Kansas. Anyway, long story short is water is still a big issue for the state. You know, you'd think it's got bipartisan support in Kansas, but the funding hasn't been there in recent years to do those water programs. And if you talk about the presidential federal government cutting back on some of those funding programs through the EPA or USDA for water programs, we're going to have to, you know, try to tackle a bigger issue with less resources, unless we can straighten out there.
So there you go with your school money, the tax money they're using for schools being used up again for something that is a necessity for life. How do the legislators learn about water concerns?
So for the first time in you know, I've been up there for 7 years now, so that's not a long time in the big scope of things. But to my understanding, there's only been this water committee. It is called Water and Environment. First committee dedicated to just water issues that I've ever heard of in Kansas state politics for a long time.
Okay.
And so they learned, you know, and only certain legislators on that committee learned about that issue through that committee. I think a lot of it rests on the citizens' shoulders and bringing that issue to the forefront. We had a Governor Brownback, who made water a top priority and did a bunch of listening tours across the state, which we were grateful for. But when it came to putting funding in the budget for water, failed to do that throughout his tenure. So as we look into the next candidate for governor, we're having that big conversation because it'll be here for the primary in August and the general election in November. Will we have water as a top issue, just as long as along with education, along with transportation issues? Is water and environmental issues going to be a top concern?
I was just thinking, I've only been to one forum, and that was with the 3rd District candidates for the Democratic Party. And I don't think a question asked at that forum had anything to do not only with water, but any environmental issue, transportation, or anything else. So when you have this little subgroup that was formed to study the water concerns for the state of Kansas, is it their responsibility to come back and tell the other legislators, or what do they do with the information that they receive?
Yeah, well, that was a big point of concern, because we felt like maybe that responsibility should have been on those committee members to continue to push for increased funding in the water plan, increased awareness of water issues throughout the state. And we don't know if that information really circulated amongst those committee members to their larger to the larger body of the state legislature. I mean, it comes down to, are our leaders making this a top priority or not? I'd say if we, no matter who the next governor is going to be, that ought to be a top issue. And not just in talking about it, but in walking the walk, too, and putting in dollars to those programs.
Yeah.
We can maybe realize, okay, we got bigger classroom sizes and not enough resources. We got broken chairs that maybe need to be replaced at schools. We can see those cuts in education programming. We can see the problems with, you know, bridges maybe not getting repaired, or roads not getting repaired, and too many potholes on the streets, et cetera. And we can see that there's been a lack of funding for transportation.
Right.
But with environmental issues that are so long-term, it's tough to see the problems and the cuts in funding actually take place.
Yeah.
Until you go to that lake and there's blue-green algae, and next thing you know, you're having to cancel plans on the lake because you're having problems there. You know what I mean there?
Okay, well, here we got a caller on the line. Caller, will you give us your first name and the part of the city you're calling from, please?
And you're on the air.
Okay, hey, Richard. This is Brent, and I'm calling from Tonganoxie, Kansas.
Yes, sir. How you doing, Brent?
I'm good. How are you?
Just fine. You one of those old Tyson guys, aren't you?
Well, yeah. That
yes,
was
sir.
An issue that we
yes,
seem
sir.
To have overcome.
Yes, sir. That was one of the things we were talking about. What you got to say, guy?
Well, I'm just curious. I'm enjoying your discussion with Zach about what is current in Kansas politics
mm-hmm.
relating to the environment. One thing that I've really been thinking about recently is our renewable energy resource that we have in Kansas. You know, we've got tremendous wind and great potential for solar. It seems like the big technology breakthroughs that we need to be putting money into and our efforts into is solutions that give us electrical energy storage on the grid. And there are such things that are being developed, but I don't hear anybody talking about that in Kansas. Sure okay. seems like we could do a lot better with our wind energy if we had a way to store it and then use it in the evenings or on the times when it's not windy. And I was just wondering if that's something that the Sierra Club pushes for or if that's even on their radar.
Okay, thank you, Brent, for your question, and we'll answer it and get back to you, Guy. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, thanks for calling in, Brent, and glad to hear a fellow Tonganoxian on the line. I went to Tonganoxie High School and just live south of there in Linwood, so appreciate your call. I think you bring up a definitely interesting and dynamic point with this energy storage with renewable energy in Kansas. Talking with some of the candidates for governor, and I've talked with all of them, but I asked, you know, are there environmental issues that have been coming up on your campaign tour? And yes. And what they come up to is earthquakes are one of those, dealing with the man-made earthquakes, but another one is renewable energy, and specifically wind energy that has brought economic prosperity. So some of our most vulnerable people in Kansas, in western Kansas,
right.
Those that are experiencing the rural flight, wind energy and putting some wind turbines on their farm has really been a cash crop for them when the other traditional crops of corn and wheat haven't come through in terms of prices. We're about 40-some percent of our energy in this area is coming from wind.
Right.
Across Kansas, I think it's closer to 35-36% of our energy now is renewable energy, which is amazing.
Right.
Because we weren't there. I mean, we were talking about this for a while.
Yeah.
We haven't been there for very long, and actually, we've brought, I think it's $8 billion with a B, $8 billion of economic investment into Kansas related to wind energy, thousands of jobs, construction jobs. There's colleges that teach wind maintenance, wind energy, turbine technicians, I think they're called. And those are some of the highest paying, most sought after jobs coming out of colleges. Cloud County comes to mind. But we haven't even, in my mind, we haven't scratched the surface on renewable energy because we don't have the energy storage capabilities.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know, you've heard it before. The continual argument is, well, what are you going to do when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine?
Right.
And energy storage fills that answer, because if we get wind that is blowing in the evening time or even during the day, and we can store that in either a battery, in a compressed air energy storage situation. I've heard about energy storage where while you have the energy blowing, you take water or something and put it up a hill and then use a gravitational force to bring it back down to spin a turbine. We should be on the frontier of this. And I know the Kansas legislature has talked about energy storage a little bit in the past, but I don't think we've dedicated a task force. I don't think our legislators are fired up about this as they should be. We have excellent opportunity in a couple different ways. I've heard about using energy storage in maybe those salt caverns near Hutchinson, where you can pressurize air into the ground and then release some of that air to spin a turbine. In fact, you know, one of our colleagues on the Sierra Club, one of our board members, that's his business is this compressed air right. energy storage. So there's that, and then they've talked about energy storage in abandoned oil wells. You know, essentially you got a tube underground that you can utilize those, which one used for fossil fuels. Utilize them for maybe a energy storage capacity too. So, and then we haven't even talked about solar. solar could be our next wind energy sector in Kansas, where we're one of the top sunniest states.
Right.
I think we're in the top 10. We're just as sunny as Florida.
And we
could, I mean, one of the number one jobs in the energy sector is solar installers.
Okay.
And those are green jobs, are good jobs. Construction people that may not be able to build a house in a certain market could put solar panels up.
Right.
So.
Well, you know, and there's some things coming out that I'm hearing them talk about in the solar industry. They talk going into the co-op kind of situation where people are owners and it's people owning it instead of an individual or whatever. And I think what BPU did with the solar farm and this concept they're working on where people are renting the panels and stuff up to so many 10 panels. That's another example of what people are trying to do to bridge this gap that exists. And Brad, I'll be honest about you. When this environmental movement got kicked in the pants in 2008, that was one of the leading stories on the docket, was the fact that it's kind of like where we were when Eisenhower brought in the interstate highway. You know, be able to get goods moved across this country. We need a grid system, and up to now, it's been fighting to be able to even engage in renewable energy. Now that the people in the state are starting to see themselves that there is some benefits in having some wind on your property where you was losing money for not being able to grow food, I think that it's put us at the next level. And I said then, and I'll say it again, in fact, when I'm talking to our young people, the next generation, that Bill Gates is going to be coming up out of the basement or the garages. It's going to be a new generation of folks. But the technology that's needed to be able to create what we're talking about creating, to make this storage of energy profitable and non-conforming, is yet to come. So that's why it's important to, you know, not feel bad about it. Understand it's on the horizon. It's coming. Like you said, coming out, people are going to college to come out with these techniques and these different skills. And I'm a full believer in understanding that that's going to happen. I'd love to be able to concentrate on the fact that the reason that we need to do it because it creates jobs. But let's come on. We need to start getting realistic. It creates jobs to build them. But once they're built, you go from 500 people building it down to 45 people maintaining it. So so it's very important that we keep that in mind, because we don't want to disillusion folks about there are the great jobs out there, and the lower ones in the spectrum are just getting started. By the time they get to a point and get ready to reap the benefits of them good jobs, it doesn't exist. So we need to figure out other ways, but other aspects of the renewable energy industry to be in educating our future generations to be able to pursue. Like you said, if it's the whatever the name of the job was you gave for the blaze, what you say was the maintenance guy, the maintenance.
Oh, yeah, turbine technician or something
technician
like that.
Turbine technician. You know, I mean, even if it's that, I think it zeroes in on a specific. And it might be more beneficial for an educator to be educating a person about being a technician.
I also want to not forget the bigger picture here. It's always important that this would be good for economy and give jobs to people and all that. But we're facing a reality of ever-changing climate here.
Right.
And the fact that we as a people are having an effect on our larger ecosystem and the global ecosystem, the atmosphere. And you know, it'll be good for jobs and building industry and all that, but let's not lose sight that we have to do some of these things.
Yep.
That we have to change our society to be more eco-friendly, because, you know, we can't afford for people to continue to get asthma from dirty energy and air pollution. We can't afford effect on a larger climate to where greenhouse gases are causing disrupt in the ecosystem, to where we're having the coldest April on record,
right,
and then the warmest May on record,
right,
and how that affects people's energy bills at their house.
Right.
And so, and people are having a conversation, well, you know, I'm going to be able to afford AC, but only at certain times. And if I'm going to have to struggle in the heat, how that, I mean, we could talk about how that affects people's mental attitudes.
Right.
And their relationship with other people.
That's
so,
right.
But at the long story short is we're going to have to change, recalibrate our energy system a little bit. And we're going to have to do so in a way that's fair and equitable to everybody,
right.
But also to have meaningful change so our future generations won't have to struggle with this climate predicament as much. So.
All right, gang, we're going to take our second break. If you would like, give us a call here, 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534, and join us in this conversation.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. 8 months after Hurricane Maria, power had still not been fully restored to the town of Mariana, Puerto Rico. So a company called Box Power shipped solar panels, batteries, and a backup generator to power a cafe, laundromat, and community center there. But unlike most renewable energy systems, this one snapped together almost like Legos, with no engineers or electricians needed.
If you can put together an IKEA bed frame, you can probably put together a microgrid system.
Angelo Campos founded Box Power. The company's portable power systems and tools needed to assemble them come in shipping containers.
The battery bank and generator can provide power from the minute it hits the ground, and the solar array can be set up in about 5 hours to provide a completely renewable source of energy.
BoxPower plans to sell these systems for use at music festivals and other events. The company will donate them to communities recovering after disasters. Campos says the need for emergency power is growing with climate change.
With the frequency and severity of natural disasters increasing with every season, we are trying to position ourselves to bring reliable and clean power to the victims of those disasters globally when they strike.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
All right, this is Richard Mabian back, and I'm here with Zach, our Sierra Club legislative lobbyist. And Zach, I'm going to hit you with some fast topics. We're going to start with fracking.
So we're still having an issue, and actually recently the community of Hutchinson had a forum town hall. They've been rocked by some earthquakes, quite a few of them in the past few months, and people were wondering, well, what's going on? Obviously if I'm feeling them, my house is feeling them, what can I do about this? How can we put an end to this? Am I going to have to take on earthquake insurance, a new expense I wasn't planning on doing? What I found out hearing about that meeting is that there are faults that we don't know about underground, geological faults. We don't know that are down there. And, in fact, some of the disposal of these fracking fluids that come up in the ground from fracking, and we have to get rid of this, they call it wastewater injection. We have to inject it back underground so it doesn't get in our water table. We get rid of it so it's not on the surface, it's underground. All the waste and water injection they're doing in south central Kansas, right on the tip of Oklahoma almost, is having effect miles away, 50 to 60 miles away in Hutchinson, Kansas. That's the best science our Kansas Geological Survey comes up with. And to me, that shows there's a problem here
right. That's
a little bigger in scope than what we initially thought. So we're trying to get some work done on that. We're having some issues in our mind of the regulatory agency putting the brakes on some of this stuff.
Where's the regulatory agency?
The Kansas Corporation Commission is charged with regulating the oil and gas industry in Kansas.
Okay.
And they permit these wastewater injection permits, the license to do that across the state. We have thousands of these wells. Well, what we come up with was since 2008, the last 10 years, we've had over 2,000 of these wells were improperly permitted. Okay.
Ooh.
They were improperly permitted 2,000 some wells. Now, some of that was just they didn't mismarked the notice window, you know, so people could protest the wells if they wanted to. They got it wrong. They were listed as 15 days. They should have been 30 days. But what we discovered in kind of unveiling some of this new, the permit errors and all that, is that folks were operating without a license, that they were drilling the permit through, and so it smells bad.
Yes.
You know, it doesn't pass a sniff test.
Where's
the accountability? Where is the accountability? That's the question we've been asking. And if we know that these are man-made earthquakes, that this is these injection of the fluids is causing the faults to shift because of the weight and the pressure underground, where is the accountability to the industry that is putting that wastewater down? Does that make sense?
I'm sitting here going, you know, people spend a lot of time with stuff that we really can't do anything about, from Trump's office to Pruitt. This is local.
Right.
Now, I got one of my members that's in charge of my political action committee, and he constantly says, the NAACP member, that all politics is local. There's got to be someone accountable for people that's out there with these fracking systems going on that don't have the proper credentials to be having them. Somebody. And then when you find out that this person was operating without the proper license, there's supposed to be some kind of process for dealing with that person or the people who allowed him to do it.
Right.
And I just don't see, I don't hear you saying.
Well, you know, I should be objective here and say that, you know, sometimes one rotten egg spoils the whole batch or whatever. We can't let the whole batch be spoiled
that
on this.
Sounds like
a lot of people go through the permit process and do it the right way and all that.
Yeah, I got
but
you.
What I would suggest is maybe there is a lack of accountability and a lack of oversight, a lack of due diligence of our regulatory agency that's supposed to be in charge of keeping us safe,
right,
has allowed for us now to say that man-made earthquakes are the norm. That instead of, and I'll give them some credit, they've slowed down the earthquakes. We don't have as many earthquakes as we did in 2014, 2015 in south central Kansas, but is that enough? We used to have no earthquakes, man-made earthquakes in Kansas, and now we have just as many earthquakes between us and Oklahoma as California.
Have they given the reason why there's been a reduction in earthquakes?
Yes, it's because they finally took regulatory action. They finally said, we're only going to allow this much injection of this wastewater. Okay, they put a cap on how much you could do, and that was shown beneficial. So one of the proposals we had, legislative proposals, a bill that we brought up at Kansas Sierra Club, was that, hey, let's make that statewide. We're seeing more earthquakes in other parts of the state. Let's make that limit statewide. If it had success, let's bring the success elsewhere.
So you
elsewhere.
Mean when they passed that particular limit, it wasn't statewide?
No.
It was just for one geographic area?
Right, right. And that the earthquakes went down in that area, but we started seeing earthquakes in other area because they didn't have that limit.
That's unreal.
And so now when we said, let's do the deal statewide, let's do that limit statewide, legislators were a little nervous. Oh, this is case-by-case geology and maybe a uniform system wouldn't work. I don't care what the solution. That was my idea for a solution. I don't care what the solution is. We just need a solution. You know, this can't stand where people's houses, public infrastructure, bridges, police buildings. A police building was affected. Firefighters were affected down in Wichita with one of the earthquakes the previous year. To where the floor's getting all, you know, disjointed. We just got to escalate these environmental issues, water issue, climate change, agricultural issues, and fracking to be, because they are on people's minds, to make them a mainstream political issue is the task that we got to do. That's our chore. That's the task in front of us.
It seems to me that what you're doing needs to be heard more routinely here, because I don't know anyone else that's talking about this the way we are. And I think it's really important for us because this is becoming a community engagement type of an issue. That's where we are. I mean, I'm not throw the bum out kind of person. I mean, let's set some standards for what the bums are doing. Excuse me, y'all, I didn't mean to call you bums. But basically, that's where we are. I mean, if we got that problem going on in fracking, I had no idea. Had no idea it was that way. We got 1 minute left, Zach. As usual, our time runs out on us.
Sure. Edgar, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Finish it up with something there real quick that you want us to be cognizant of or aware of.
Sure. No matter what issue is important to you, an environmental issue, social issue, the best thing we do is actualize our civic duty. Get out there, pay attention to the political process, get out there and vote, and then also be a citizen lobbyist when the legislature comes back in January.
Okay, gang. We thank you, Zach, for being here with us. And
always a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, as always. I always love having you here. All right, folks, have a good week and try to stay warm. Stay cool out there in that rain.
Save the Last KC Forest is hosting a Preserve the Line Creek Forest hike tonight from 7 to 9. The hike is around 2.5 miles and will last between 1 and 2 hours. Participants will meet at the Line Creek Trail Platte Brook North Trailhead at 3700 Northwest Platte Brook Drive in Kansas City. The Save the Last KC Forest organization has expressed concerns about the removal of forest for public school expansion. Save the Last KC Forest has called into question some of the practices that the school district has engaged in clearing land for Park Hill Elementary School, including burning the trees and doing so on ozone alert days. The Park Hill School District is also having their school board meeting on Thursday. The meeting will be at the district office at 7 p.m., those intending to speak during the public comments should arrive 10 minutes early to complete a comment card. More info at lastkcforest.com.
Missed last week's Echo Radio KC? No worries. You can listen online at kkfi.org.
Want to know the weather in L.A.? Look at New Zealand. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Antarctica's ice sheets are melting 3 times faster per year than they were before 2011. So says recent research published in the journal Nature, and the ice melt and resulting sea level rise will catch some coastal cities off guard.
It's already predicted that by the end of the century, sea levels will rise by 2 feet, and the new information increases that estimate by another half a foot.
The study was done by 88 scientists, and one of them, Ian Jogan of the University of Washington, told the Washington Post that part of West Antarctica is in a state of collapse. Another researcher said that there are no other plausible signals to be driving the melt other than climate change.
Inside Climate News reports that coastal flooding is an increasing problem even now. According to a NOAA report also released last week, the frequency of high tide inundation has doubled in the past 30 years.
Gadolinium is a chemical that is used in MRIs to improve the visibility of tumors, organs, and blood vessels. However, gadolinium is now accumulating in the world's oceans, and no one knows how significant its impact will be on ecosystems.
About 30 million patients in the U.S. are injected with gadolinium-based agents each year before they have MRIs. Most of it passes out of the body through urine. The element can then get into wastewater that ends up in oceans if it's not first filtered out.
Research published in Poland shows that it can affect marine life. Jellyfish and tiny plankton are sensitive to the gadolinium. One of the researchers told Hekai magazine that the health impacts on marine life and humans are not well understood, including how it interacts with other pollutants.
But it is possible to filter out gadolinium from wastewater, even though not required in the U.S. The city of Boulder, Colorado, installed a system in 2008 that removes the element as well as other endocrine disruptors that affect fish.
Want to know if it's going to rain in L.A.? Watch what happens near New Zealand.
Scientists at the University of California, Irvine, have discovered a strong correlation between precipitation in the southwest with sea surface temperatures near New Zealand, and they say it's an earlier and more accurate method of forecasting.
Sea surface temperatures in the Pacific near New Zealand begin changing in July and August. There is either cooling or heating. The commensurate changes strengthen or weaken the jet stream in the northern hemisphere, which has a direct effect on the amount of rain that falls in California between November and March.
Science Daily reports that El Niño was thought to be a reliable tool for weather prediction in the southwest, but its power has diminished, possibly due to climate change.
Some very old trees in Africa have died abruptly in the last decade, and researchers say the likely culprit is climate change.
Baobab trees can grow to be as wide as a bus's long and can live to 3,000 years old, but 9 of the oldest have died. A study published in the journal Nature Plants found that 4 of the dead trees were the largest in Africa. All of those were in the south of the continent, where warming is occurring faster than the global average.
The online journal The Conversation notes that baobab trees store massive amounts of water and bear fruit that feeds both animals and humans. The trees are important elements of the ecosystem, keeping soils humid, stemming erosion, and recycling nutrients.
The Senate Appropriations Committee approved a spending bill on Thursday, which included a requirement that the Trump administration release a scientific study it has so far buried.
The study recommends that the safety level for PFAS chemicals be 6 times lower than the current EPA guideline. The chemicals have been detected in drinking water near military facilities at nearly 130 bases in the U.S.
Politico found through emails that the report recommending the lower level has not been released by the administration because it would create a public relations nightmare.
But the Senate committee expressed disappointment that the study has not yet been released and required its disclosure within 15 days of passage of the bill.
And finally, let's talk about endings, as in what should happen to our bodies when we die. 2 years ago, cremation became more common than burial in the U.S., a shift attributed to high costs and the waning importance of religion.
But there are also environmental concerns. More than 4 million gallons of toxic embalming fluids and 20 million feet of wood are put in the ground in the U.S. every year, while a single cremation emits as much carbon dioxide as a 1,000-mile car trip.
That's led to the rise of green burials, where bodies are wrapped in biodegradable material and not embalmed. But there's another method gaining popularity, water cremation, or as it's scientifically known, alkaline hydrolysis.
The New Republic reports alkaline hydrolysis was patented in 1888, and the process hasn't changed much since then. The body is submerged in a solution of about 95% water and 5% alkali, usually sodium or potassium hydroxide. The liquid is heated at high pressure, just below boiling, causing the body to decompose.
The remaining liquid goes down the drain and is treated like any other type of wastewater, a fact that has caused some lawmakers and religious leaders to compare it to flushing loved ones down the toilet.
But its supporters, like Philip Olson, a death studies expert at Virginia Tech, says it's a kinder way to treat a body, rather than embalming, which is invasive and violent, or cremation, which is fire. Alkaline hydrolysis, he said, is more like a warm bath.
And while water cremation is promoted as more ecologically sound, the process uses about 300 gallons of water per body, about 3 times as much as the average person uses in a day.
If you want water cremation in your wishes, you might have a hard time. It's only legal in 15 states, a fact casket makers and the Catholic Church are working to make sure stays that way.
That's it for this week in Water. We'll see you next time. This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association, highlighting the latest cost-effective strategies to manage aging infrastructure at the Water Infrastructure Conference and Expo, October 28th to 31st in Atlanta. Learn more at awwa.org/H2O Infocon.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.